LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Gerry O'Neill, who joins us to discuss his book, Unvaxxed Soul, A Post-Pandemic Spirit Journey. What if the real journey after lockdown isn't across a map, but into your own soul? Gerry's book is a post-lockdown road memoir and search for faith and inner freedom while navigating the wild beauty of the west of Ireland, a raw, reflective, quietly rebellious account set on the back roads and byroads of the countryside. When old certainties crack and the world's explanations ring hollow, one man realizes that no expert, institution, politics, or movement can give him the inner peace he's searching for. Slowly, the outward road trip becomes an inward one. The search shifts from the world outside to the one within. Memory, grief, fractured relationships, old shame, new learnings, and stubborn streaks of faith, a long, faltering search for a lived soul heart. If you ever felt out of step with the crowd, suspicious of easy answers, or drawn to a spirituality that's messy, human, and hard-won, Unvaxxed Soul is a companion for the long road home. Hello and welcome, Gerry, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thanks for having me.
Gerry, as I mentioned off air, I've been aware of your presence out there for a while, your writing and so the podcast you've been on, and just as a thinker and someone who having lived through the experience that we all have in the last few years, shall we say, and global events, medical crisis, whatever it happened to be, and that came for many people. I think it seemed to be a lot, if not the making of them, there's certainly it sorted out the wheat from the chaff in a lot of ways, I felt, and we already got to see who people were. And it was during that period that I became aware of yourself. You've just published a book of your writings, mostly fairly short pieces that you've compiled, I guess, some of it from your online writing. The title of the book is Unvaxxed Soul, A Post-Pandemic Spirit Journey. Now that's widely available. People will find links to get that on the interview page here. But before we dive in, tell listeners, if they're not familiar with your work, a little bit about yourself and then the genesis of the book.
Well, thanks a million, Greg, for having me on. And I suppose I've been writing for about 9 years. It'll be coming up in 9 years in February of next year. But I suppose where I've kind of developed an audience or readership, if you like, has been over the last 4 years on Substack, on a platform called The West Awake. And I've parsed through the last 4 years in real time, if you like, and this book is kind of a strand of my writing that has been ever present through the 4 years. But I would say most people are familiar mostly with my writing on, from COVID to vaccines to mass immigration in Ireland and the various kind of global agendas that are at play. I suppose through that period of time, I've had this parallel journey going on about looking at the outside world, increasingly viewing it as a type of drama that's not very real. And this book is the threading together of those pieces, maybe about 50 pieces I've written over the last 4 years, that have been more an internal examination of the lights and shadows within me as I'm looking at the lights and shadows in the world, the number one question I've come to over time is, oh, if that is true, if this is some sort of, I guess, spiritual, energetic battle in the outer world, where am I in this battle, or how well prepared am I for the next few steps of it? And it's writing that's of a more personal nature, if you like, than what my readership would be. That people generally come to my writing through the political or the current affairs, but this is much more of a introspective book.
Yeah, it's not autobiography by any means, but it is very personal. People do. I certainly, learned a lot about you from reading these pieces, as diverse as they are. There is a common thread running through them, if you see what I mean. So, for something that was written at different periods of time and where you're in different spaces in your head, in your heart, it kind of hangs together very well. So it's coherent, very coherent in that sense. You're talking about the outer world. I mean, my last posted interview at Legalized Freedom was with Kingsley Dennis. That went up a few days ago, and his phrase for what you kind of call Lego Town is the theater of the absurd, which, and we mentioned talking about the pandemic period. I reflected in that interview how during that time I felt that I was like on a film set. Like I was literally looking around to see, where are the cameras, where's the boom mic, where's the catering van, like I'm, because I'm on a set here, you know what I mean? I'm not quite sure what role I'm supposed to play. We'll certainly be talking about what we've all lived through with the pandemic. We'll be talking about Ireland as well. So for listeners who've just joined us at the start of this discussion, it's not about any one thing per se. So we're going to touch a lot of bases, but I mean, you clearly felt like that as well. In terms of like looking at the outer world and going, hang on a minute, where's Jeremy Beadle here? Is he going to jump out from behind the scenery? But also, yes, and Thomas Sheridan, one of my regular guests, reflected this about you talking about a spiritual battle. And one thing that it did for me personally, you can give me your take on this, is living through that C-19 period, it finally galvanized within myself what I knew all along, have done since I was quite young, that there is a non-material dimension to reality. It's actually probably the central one, and the five sense three-dimensional world is probably just some kind of surface appearance, and that we are here for a reason. We're here to do something. And the C-19 period really galvanized me and focused me and saying, what are you going to do? Now you're in your 50s, me personally, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? It's time to actually engage with this, in a more meaningful way. So I think it really spurred me to action in that sense.
Yeah, no, look at I think I'm in, we're of a similar mindset there. I refer to, it as Lego Town, Matrix, whatever the machine Paul Kingsnorth kind of calls it. My feeling on it is that once you become aware of it, it becomes quite dangerous to. You need to be careful how you interact with it. It's almost, and it's quite dangerous to. It can be quite dangerous to interact with it if. It's almost the way I would frame it, because everybody has their own, methodology of how they go about their own personal spirituality. I describe myself as spiritually curious in a way I wasn't 4 years ago, and the pandemic is the central character there then, because that was the. That was the awakening moment for me, at some point in 2021, I began to ask questions, and I didn't start this journey as like somebody with a huge amount of knowledge about vaccines or any of this stuff. I just, it was always a freedom question for me, and how that the state in Ireland anyway. Coercing the people in such an obvious and authoritarian manner were overstepping not just freedom, but it was like a forced intimacy with the people that, almost like if you're having a conversation with somebody and they step into your personal space and they won't leave it. So it started there where I had questions and I was looking for genuine answers, and all I got was more questions. And that is, I've been down several rabbit holes since on various different things. And even the, you know, even this, even going into rabbit holes is a danger for me anyway, in the future head, is because you can sometimes never get out of them. And you start to look at the world just through the prism of the rabbit hole, so that everything in your day-to-day life is suddenly related back to whatever that might be. And so I kind of, that's kind of where I'd be. So like, as in going forward, it's like you can't unsee what you've seen. And if you attempt to be walk blind, having learned and seen what you've seen, you're going to get yourself into even more trouble, I think, in the outer world and in the inner world.
Yeah, I spent a year because the project only really lasted a year. David Icke, back about 10, 12 years ago, did a crowdfunding thing for this thing called the People's Voice. And I had, mixed feelings about the thing, but I myself forward to get involved because I thought I've just got whatever happens, this is going to be interesting. So I spent the best part of a year traveling up and down from London on that. Where I'm going with this is quite simply that I met Ike then on a few occasions, had one-on-one conversations with him, found him to be a genuine guy. I think he's a decent human being, and he's definitely been on to a number of things early doors, because I have a memory of him coming to the university that I attended back in 1993 to do a lecture, and he was widely ridiculed, and about maybe half a dozen people showed up to see him speak. So, but I mention this because I think he is someone who has that prism, one prism through which he sees everything. And he's been right about so many things, but I think he's also been his own worst enemy in some ways. I'd put Alex Jones in the same camp as well, the US radio shock jock, or whatever you want to call him. And so, yeah, I do think you're absolutely right. You have to use your own discernment, but you have to be ready to. Not to have, that expression about not having such an open mind that your brain falls out, but you have to be re ready to recalibrate, don't you, when you get new information?
Absolutely. And I think I agree with you about David Icke. And David Icke's only David Icke, just to be clear, is somebody I would have kept at arm's length in my head for 20 years. Do you know what I mean? I'd have known of his existence. But, I think every David Icke, I was it's funny you mention his name, because I was watching an interview he did on some fairly big mainstream platform there in the last couple of weeks, and I thought, how reasonable does he sound now? Like, do you know what I mean? And that's the thing. The problem for David, I would say, and it's a problem for everybody in their own way, is that, when you're a kind of when you're a person that is kind of revealing truth, uncomfortable truth, or light, one of the biggest problem you have is that light attracts shadow straight away. That's the way I kind of term it to myself. And you're gonna have to interact and deal with that. And like, I can't imagine how anyone could have dealt with it any better than he's dealt with it. Given, the levels of kind of mocking, derision, everything else he must have gone through for a good 15 years when after he came out first.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that his whole that notorious Wogan appearance, with the aquamarine shell suit, whatever he was wearing, he acknowledged himself that that was him kind of having this awakening event in public. It would have been best if that had happened behind closed doors, and he'd gathered his thoughts and composed himself, and then appeared in the media. So that whole son of God thing and all of that misunderstanding. But I have to say, as someone who grew up being a fan of Terry Wogan, mainly because of his commentary on the Eurovision Song Contest, which was always hilarious. I came to really, look, Wogan was just, I kind of say, I don't think any other media person would have done any different really back at that time, but I kind of lost respect from there. I just thought, you're not even hearing this guy at all. You're literally mocking him, laughing at him for ratings, basically. At a time when there was no internet, actually, so there was no way to just view the clip again, blah blah blah.
And there was no way for him to respond either in any other fashion than he was being portrayed for year, like for a good few years afterwards. I suppose why he's a kind of important, and like I'll put it maybe let's if we bring in a contemporary figure, or event, and just when you're talking about truths and people that are kind of at the forefront of certain things, and why it's important people need to be kind of grounded is, if you take the Charlie Kirk assassination or whatever it was, and you consider it from the point of view of not being down any particular kind of train of thought on it, and you might say, well, there's the official narrative, which is, lone gunman shoots Charlie Kirk. Then there's the second broader one where that's being offered by the likes of Candace Owens and others, that there's a kind of a darker force there, something to maybe along the lines of, Israeli influence, or a combination of security forces that have worked together. And then there's the third one, which is on which was which would be probably towards a David Icke early 1990s, is that Charlie Kirk isn't dead at all, and that this is a big grand theater. Now, the problem where people might listen, say, to the third one there, that this was completely set up, that he's actually not dead, whereas that strain of thought might have been 0.5% of or 1% number of people 20 years ago, it's probably 15% of the people that are looking at this today, or maybe more. And there is a problem, and I'm just using this example because I'm somewhere between two and three, if I was to be forced into looking at it. But there's a big problem, number one, in terms of reaching objective truths, universal truths that we used to be able to arrive at, i.e., there are men and there are women. Whereas today, there's always going to be 15% of the population or more that will never arrive at a universal truth. So a universal truth or objective truth has been destroyed over the last number of years. There's a combination of reasons why that might be, and we can go into them. But I would just point out to myself why this is the grounding aspect is important, is that if option number two is the true one, there are some amalgamation of facts around the second option. Get yourself, well, maybe, it's what we kind of always talk, going back to the JFK days, that there's a nefarious force of people that are really controlling the world, and it might be, 5% of an elite. Well, that's one thing. But if it's actually number three, the monumental level of lying or untruth in the day-to-day world would be so huge that I can't see how the revelation of it wouldn't collapse kind of humanity as we know it. And it's probably the main reason where I'd be, when I bump into something like that, I'd say, if I go too far down that rabbit hole, I'll never come out of it, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, very much so. I mean, you're talking, you mentioned JFK. Well, that's one of the classic quote unquote conspiracy theories, isn't it? I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me, given all the years and years of research and the time that's passed, in the meantime, that I would just say that the official narrative doesn't hold that much water. And it seems, I mean, again, it's not wild to say that the story of JFK's assassination is not exactly how it was presented to us. Lots of
No,
things are
or
like that, and then the moon landing falls into the same camp.
yeah.
Whatever you think about it, I just don't think we have all the concrete facts regarding that. And then the thing that we lived through in the modern era is 9/11, and around pandemic time, I made a video called COVID 9/11, a warning from history, because I wasn't very far into the pandemic period with the media response and various things that were occurring. I thought, hang on a minute, I've been through all this. The first time I went to an airport, I was flying to Sweden after 9/11, and it was like belts off, shoes off, no bottles of water. And literally prior to 9/11, if you'd s said to me, oh, by the way, I've seen the future and the following security measures are going to be in place at airports, I'd have said, pardon the pun, that won't fly. People are not going to take off their boots and take off their belt and be like go through a body scanner and get retina scans, as happened to me when I went to New York. They're not going to do that, but they just went along with it like that. No resistance almost whatsoever. So, and when the pandemic period came along, I thought, I've lived through something like this before. Therefore, I am not surprised at people's utter capitulation. And more than that, actually, just either begging for it or loving it or some combination of the two, you know.
Absolutely. And like the way I would look at everything is our capacity to defend ourselves from that is getting ever, ever weaker. Again, 9/11 is not something I ever questioned until the pandemic. And even now, the way I'd approach that is, okay, there's major question marks there on a range of them. But I don't need to go back to that one to know. Like, if no, the way I'd frame 9/11 to my head is, if the absolute truth to 9/11 came out and it is the most extreme version of what happened there, it won't surprise me. And as I, but I don't, I don't need to, for the next third of my life or the last third of my life, that's not something I need to get to the bottom of personally, and it's not gonna help me in any kind of way other than question everything, which I'm gonna be doing, which would be my modus operandi anyway for the way forward, is just question everybody and everything, because we are rapidly transforming from our physical identities to our digital identities. And it seems to me we're probably in a place now where the digital identity is more important than the physical identity in the power structures that are forming to control the future. And we need to individually reject that as much as we can, and then collectively too.
Yeah, I mentioned my recent interview with Kingsley. One thing I addressed in that was something that I was going to be working up over the next couple of weeks before the end of the year anyway. A response to the UK government's announced plans for digital ID. And it was really for me, everything now has a metaphysical, spiritual dimension, some kind of underlay going on beneath the surface, that's sometimes more important than surface events themselves. And UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer saying, in this parliament, I have only another 2 or 3 years to run. We will introduce digital ID for all citizens. It's spelling as in magical spells. It's, the first thing of magic is, put it into words, write it down, state your intent backed by emotion, desire, by will. And that's what that's a form of, whether he's aware of it or not. And my video response is going to be, whoa, hang on a minute here. Was already people in the sort of alternative community, if I can put it that way, saying, oh, what are we going to do when this happens? And I'm saying, back up a bit. Stop manifesting this by saying it's going to happen.
So like I'm vague. We have the same problem issue in Ireland, except the Irish method of trying to introduce it is to bring in a digital ID for under 16s, for their protection of going on certain social media platforms. But obviously that brings in a digital kind of ID for everybody. But that sounds to me like a manifestation practice that Keir Starmer is trying there, and it is definitely, like, whether he knows it or not, and I'd be leaning towards, any time I look at him, he probably has an awareness that it is in a certain sense magic he's attempting there.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, absolutely it is. And again, you see, he doesn't have to be aware of it. You know, they can be like useful idiots, or they can be knowing players. But as far as Ireland goes, this is something like we're both from that, has been for some time now, divided nation. For people who are not familiar with Ireland, you're from the south of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, so called. That's about 2/3, 3/4 of the island itself, something like that.
Yeah, about maybe 2/3, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, and then I'm from the north, which for a long time now has been part of the United Kingdom. The official name is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And the reason I mention it is because when we went through the pandemic period, obviously I was in contact with many people from the south, and Thomas Sheridan being a good, he's a high profile example of someone that my listeners will be aware of, and others. And I have this sort of slightly, it's probably quite a typical Northern Irish perspective on Ireland, because I'm entitled to hold an Irish passport. I don't have one, but even though I was born in Northern Ireland, I can do that as a, being born on the island of Ireland, the Irish government will allow me to have a passport. And people say, are you Irish? I grew up in a Protestant religious tradition, so there would have been people in my circle who would consider themselves loyalists, as it were, that in support of the UK government did not want Northern Ireland to be subsumed back into, a united Ireland again. I had some family who, well, still do actually live in Dublin. A part of that family included my uncle, no, sadly no longer with us. He was actually an Englishman. So it was that kind of like combination of Northern Irish people and an Englishman living in Dublin, and where I would visit. But you're getting this experience of the Republic of Ireland without really living it. And it certainly in the 70s and 80s, it genuinely felt like going to another country, which in many ways it was. Different currency and different, road markings and all that sort of stuff. The reason I bring this up is because I looked on at what was happening with the Irish government during the pandemic with very mixed feelings, of kind of feeling like, I guess I'm Irish, but also what the Irish government is doing, because they were almost up there with the New Zealand government, weren't they, in terms of fanaticism. Somehow not affected by it as well, whereas you were in the eye of the storm in that sense.
Yeah, I think me and Thomas were having, I've one of the great kind of lessons over the last 4 years is some of the people that have kind of become friends, and Thomas has been one of them, and we've done things together, and but I we were having a conversation there 2 weeks ago, and we both came to the conclusion that when we go over the bar, the invisible border into Northern Ireland, we have this sense that we're actually going into Ireland and not leaving Ireland. And I was thinking about that afterwards, and it's because, the whatever the historic issues between, we'll say, the Protestant and Catholic traditions in Ireland as manifest through loyalism or hardline republicanism, that's a shared history on the island that goes back hundreds of years. So in a sense, that's interwoven into our existence, if you like. As Irish people, and however you might visualize that, your visualization might be different, but we both understand each other's part in that history and importance of that going forward. And I think one of the problems with the South at the moment is that our state, our institutions, our government have, in a way, rejected the importance of the indigenous population of Ireland. And that those ties have loosened. And one of the things I noticed during COVID, because I used to, the book that I wrote is episodic, so each chapter is written in the moment in time that I originally wrote it in. So, but one of those occasions was going to a kind of a retreat event in Clonmacnoise, which would be a fairly, probably one of the most significant spiritual sites in Ireland, and it goes back really thousands of years. And it dawned on me that Protestant, we'll say Protestant and hardline Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland were on the same page when it came to COVID, a lot of them. And they found actually a lot of there was a lot of agreement and kind of strange alliances that would never have happened 20 years ago at, or 25 years ago at the dawn of, we'll say, in the lead up to the Good Friday Agreement. They recognized what was coming was in some way a demonic force and rejected it. And I found that aspect. I don't think I've heard anyone kind of comment on that aspect, but there's been quite a lot of agreement internally on the island, I would suggest, on the four unspeakables is how I phrase it. And COVID vaccinations would be one, but the others would be, the climate, transgender, and this mass immigration project that seems to be targeted at every country in Europe, not just Ireland.
Well, you had that strange spectacle. Well, it's quite uplifting, actually, of the protest marches. I'm not sure if they were in Belfast or where exactly. Maybe in multiple locations with the tricolours and the Ulster flags and the Union Jacks all in the same crowd. I don't know if that occurred anywhere in the south, but that kind of was, was almost like, when countries become united in times of war or in times of alien invasion or whatever. It was almost like the people realised that there was something that more above, more immediate and more important than their traditional tribal divisions, if you see what I mean, or their agendas for the future of the country. They realized there was a threat to them all,
Well, I
coming
think
from this.
Well, I think they both recognized is that whatever their political agenda, we'll say that unionists might have and Republicans might have, that this new that this new force sweeping the south and up into the north was going to betray both and replace both. So if you sense it was like a this globalized multiculturalism. And I like the South isn't it, the South of Ireland, and particularly on the East Coast, the way I look at it is there's 8 or 10 different kind of na with big presences. It's not just it's not like it's not like a single country's people or country's religion coming into the country. It's this mishmash of up to 20 different nationalities, and within those nationalities, there's tensions. Never mind within whatever tensions they might, particular strands of that immigration might have with the indigenous population. So it's a mess is the only way you could describe it down here.
Well, that the establishment or elites or both contempt for indigenous people are certainly is very much alive and unfortunately burgeoning in mainland Britain as well. So, I mean, maybe Ireland's just got a more virulent strain of it, but amongst the people in positions of power, but there's certainly contempt for working class people. And also it doesn't ju it's not strictly across ethnic or racial lines or even in
No.
terms of, because you'll find a lot of during the I mentioned to you off air about the pandemic period, really sorting the wheat from the chaff. You kind of now time to see who's who, do you know what I mean? And
Yes.
it really a lot of people reveal themselves to be something that other people perhaps you learned who your friends were, I think, in some ways, and certainly I lost friends at that time. But you saw a sort of a knowledge, an instinctive understanding of what was going on. I saw it amongst, I mean, I had a, for a lot of that period, I was living in the apartment I was living in. There was another apartment complex being built across the road. And I would see a lot of young men, the builders on the site, it was all men, young men. And the sort of the way they would laughingly shrug off the stuff that was coming to them. In the media at that time, they could smell bullshit. Do you know what I mean? So, and they instinctively
Absolutely,
understood
yeah.
that. And a lot of the guys on the site were actually Polish or Eastern European. But they were like, no, we love it here. We like England. England is good. Wales is good. Scotland is good. We love it. We earn good money here. We want to be. We want to fit in with you guys. And we see what's being done here. So it was divisive in many ways. Again, putting divisions where you wouldn't necessarily expect them. I don't know if you personally had relationships that were casualty to all of that. I did, for sure. But yeah, so there was dividing lines where you wouldn't necessarily expect, and there were people coming together in common cause that you wouldn't, in along lines you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Absolutely, because like the first people that were, because Ireland, not to put too fine a point, but 92%, if the figures can be believed, of the population got the initial two injections of COVID-19 vaccine, mRNA vaccines. So what was left at the end after all the coercion was just distilled down to 8% of the population. And a great many of those people were, some of the people I'm still friendly were the Polish community in Ireland, who kind of recognized not just the vaccination, but what was co the methodology being utilized was exactly the same methodology being utilized in the old Soviet Union. And this is not your, this is communism coming into your country. You need to stop it. And this was pre kind of the 22 Ukraine war and what that all kicked off in Ireland in terms of huge numbers of non-EU peoples coming into Ireland, not just Ukrainians, but from across the board. So there's always this attempt when you try to talk on any of these topics is that you're in, there's a label out there for you, like whether it's racism, xenophobia, whatever it is. But like my personal group of people that I would be in contact with will say, in my day-to-day life, that's got more diversity than any government minister in Ireland has on their phone.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, for me, the sort of the relationships that were made and broken through the pandemic, mostly made, I'm pleased to say, had a precursor in the Brexit thing. That was the United Kingdom voting to exit the European Union, which I'm sure most listeners will remember that. Historically, though, technically, I'm a bit of a pedant on this one. It should have been called UKEXIT. Because it wasn't just Britain that was voting to leave, it was the United Kingdom, including Northern Ireland. So it should have been called UKEXIT, but that's not quite as catchy.
No.
But I had a couple of people on the podcast who were what you'd call Eurosceptic. They thought that Brexit would be a good idea. But even though I didn't really have a dog in the fight, simply because I spoke with them and asked them to explain what they thought and why they thought it, that was enough for some people to cut me off. Because if I was even going to have a conversation with someone who was in favor of Brexit, I was Satan. And very similar things happened during the pandemic.
Yeah, no, and one of the side elements for Ireland is actually a lot of and again, it doesn't get frequently talked about, and I don't actually write about it that much. But Brexit had a massive impact on what's happened. Brexit has, we're feeling an impact from Brexit on the mass immigration stuff that's happening in Ireland now, and but we also, Ireland's economy has particularly performed well since the UK left the European Union. And again, that's down to Brexit as the last remaining English-speaking country in the European Union. So what I would say is that there's an element, like when Brexit happened, it was like one of the, it was a funny thing because, I would have been in my 20s and 30s a kind of a political junkie or current affairs junkie. And Brexit and Trump's first election surprised me, but what really surprised me was some of my kind of peer group and how emotionally they reacted to both of those things back in 2016. I think they both were in 16, weren't they? And that was a signifier to me. It was almost like a revelation of something, a difference between me and a few people that I knew that I'd never seen or noticed before in my life until these two kind of decisions had a way of revealing something in them that I would never have seen otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd almost, how could you forget about Donald Trump? But I certainly, when he was first elected, I interviewed a couple of people around that, one of whom was just observing it as a phenomenon, you know, as a change, cultural, political, social change in North America. I had another person on who was broadly in favor of what Trump was wanting to do. So let's give the guy a chance, you know what I mean? Because the Democrats, it was James Howard Koster, actually. He's a well-known writer, political and social commentator in the States. And he was a one-time Democrat who's came out more or less in favor of Trump and said, look, you know, the Democrats are just a rotten system. You know, they're destroying America, you know, by design, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that was another episode that I went through where it was people like you talk to someone who had something vaguely positive to say about Donald Trump, ergo, you're Satan. Just to, you know, and a lot of people there.
It was like, Now, I suppose, one of the things for me is, like, and why it wasn't that much of an issue for me is I think I quit drinking. Like, there's two decisions in my life, and the book is basically a journey from the first through the second, but like, one has been to quit drinking, and that actually happened in January of 2017, we'll say, when Trump took office. But the that decision had a natural effect of kind of removing me from my social circle by virtue of not spending time in pubs anymore or not interacting with people and the conversations that are having. You'd be having in those scenarios, so that in a sense, by time 3 or 4 years later, when COVID arrived, I was ready for it. Like, there was no great loss in the my day-to-day life because I'd kind of things pared down to basically work and home, and work was, work was removed because I was working for home for the first year and a half of COVID until I quit my job to go full time writing. But so I think when I look back on that now, I look at that as a kind of a blessing, is because I was free to come to some conclusions just through my own observations of the world rather than maybe certain social constructs that would have been in place that I mightn't have been comfortable exploring in the places I was most often found. Like, my thing with the Trump Brexit thing was that there was an emotional almost reaction to those two things from people that couldn't quite accept what the majority of a population had decided in both cases. And it was like, that was the element I couldn't of. It was almost an over emotion about two decisions that I just couldn't understand.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had Americans tell me that, again, in their own selves, you know, good people. Oh, yeah, everyone in America hates Trump. You know, nobody likes the direction America is going in. I said, well, probably about 51% of them do. Something like that. You know, and the same went for Brexit as well. It's interesting that you mentioned your relationship, if I can put it like that, with alcohol and January 2017, because I was reading an article the other day. It was about people who have a maybe a dysfunctional relationship with alcohol. For whatever reason, they decide to cut it out of their life, and they say that especially if someone's actually an alcoholic, you know, they can categorize themselves in that way that they never forget when they quit drinking. You know, it's not something like, oh, you know, wait, so you had a problem with alcohol, blah blah blah. Not you personally, Jerry, but you know, someone,
Oh no, I
and
did. Like, I am an
yeah.
alcoholic. I have no problem saying it. But one thing about me is, I did. It was only in the when I could never. I've never been able to remember until I went to writing this book. The act was a 2017 or 2018 January of, but it was just through the process of this that I got back to the date. Now that sounds might sound a little weird, but I would have been someone that went to AA religiously for a year. But it was also in that first month or two after I quit drinking that I started to write. And I've even it's in the book. I need to be careful about writing too, because generally I probably have an addictive personality, and while writing might the written word might be what you might classify as a more positive addiction, it can leave you down, it can lead me into the into wrong mind spaces and stuff like that. So, and I think that's where the more personal nature of some of the writing kind of saves me, from getting too over emotional about the bads in the world or the bads in Ireland. And, writing from a kind of negative space. And, one of the things, one of the conclusions I'm increasingly coming to is that the forces, however you want to frame them, whether they're, the elites in the world or whether that's a negative spiritual energy, they really want you to engage with them in a negative, low vibrational space. And if you do, they are winning. So.
Oh, very much so. And I told myself, again, it's something that I'd encountered during trying times in my life in general. But when we went through the aftermath of 9/11, nothing like the pandemic, but there was still an aftermath. There were still social and cultural and political changes happening. But during, C19, I said to myself, I am not going to stop living, because the whole mantra then was save lives, stop living. And
Which
I,
is, yeah, exactly,
absurd.
yeah.
And I said, I'm not going to do this. We've got, there's something occurring here. We don't quite know what it is, but clearly there are, there's something going on in society, more or less globally. Though it's interesting to look at the places in the world that were more or less untouched and how much that was to do with their psychology around it and their attitude to it and what they believed as opposed to what was actually happening. So I went out of my home every single day during that period. For exercise or to, I probably did more grocery shopping during that time than I ever have in terms of like going to the supermarket every single day, and I refused to psychologically give into it because especially at the start, we didn't know how long this was going to go on for.
No.
I made some vlogs around that time that were a bit apocalyptic. I said to myself, something I was intimately involved with for many years, live music. What will the impact be on live music going forward? What will the impact be on pubs? Something you're very familiar with. What will the impact be on travel? We didn't know. I said, if this goes on for the rest of my life, I'm not going to be hiding under a table until I'm 95.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the live music is a good one because human, natural human connection or spontaneous connection is what life, you eliminate that from life, it's not worth living. So what are you fighting for? So one of the things I would have been like about, because the Irish method of approaching COVID was that the longer it went on, the more people in power were possessed by continuing it. So the last 3 months of 2021 in Ireland were dark, dark times because energetically, because we had our Taoiseach leader of the country coming out saying, well, we might be able to have the future will be about having pockets of freedom, but things are never going to go back to the way they were. And like, I was like, what in the name of God are you talking about? But in a, one of the simplest ways I look at COVID in Ireland was we locked down the whole country when we had about 30 cases of the original strand of it. And we reopened the country in full when there was hundreds of thousands of cases a week in January of 2022. So you can nearly see the lie of it in just that one statistic.
Oh yeah, I mean the whole thing was like just a fabrication. I'm not saying that there weren't ill people. There's always ill
Yeah.
people, but you're right about the crazy making, deranging decisions, counterintuitive, just on the face of it, insane, absurd, almost laughable. If you don't laugh, what are you going to do? You're going to cry. Things that were being asked to do. The whole thing of like I can't remember exactly what the restrictions were in the Republic of Ireland, but certainly in the UK, kind of like Yeah, if you go to the pub, you can't go to the pub for a beer. Well, you can, but you need to buy a burger because buying a burger somehow means you're not going to get COVID. But if you just have a pint, you're going to get COVID.
Well, if yeah, when you see that's we introduced the vaccine certificate, which, if you like, was is a precursor to a digital identity, ID. And the country went. What surprised me the most was that the actual, in my naivety, I thought the vaccinated population will not put up with the fact that the government are basically treating us like, Berlin 1938. In terms of not allowing the unvaccinated into cafes, pubs, restaurants. And at the end of December 2021, they were talking about expanding the range of things the unvaccinated in Ireland couldn't do. And that just were why that's frightened me was how quickly we got there. Because the same government parties that didn't, waited to the last minute before they introduced COVID restrictions back in the day, and they were talking about freedom and the importance of this, that, and the other. The minute they got, the power did corrupt them absolutely, as the old saying goes.
Yeah, it was like sliding down a greased fireman's pole in terms of like how they got from like a standing start to like, the maximum level of restrictions that was eventually arrived at. And in fact, we've touched upon the immigration question, which is another kind of like you get cancelled if you even mention it. The digital ID that we mentioned earlier that Keir Starmer's talking about in the UK is under the umbrella of countering illegal immigration and all the attendant problems there. So what was attempted in the past, with the COVID thing, as you say, just a backdoor to digital ID for everyone in terms of a health pass, it's now been like, oh, well, your right to live and work in this case, the United Kingdom, get a digital ID. Then all of these grooming gangs and all the rest of the attendant problems. That somehow goes away if you've got this, digital ID.
No, I absolutely like, but I would say my sense is that all of this is going to collapse. Now, I can't explain why I feel that way, but I do. In a certain sense, I think the need for all these obvious tools of control is indicative of the fact of to the fact of how hard and desperate keep the kind of the curtain closed on what's going on how the world actually operates.
Oh, it's your Wizard of Oz guy behind the curtain, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think this is, I don't know how much death and destruction the world has to go through for that to get to the other side of that, if you like. But I do that process is accelerating, not just here or UK, but everywhere. And I just don't know how, what the trigger point is for that, in terms of kind of almost complete collapse of all this nonsense. But my positive will say my outlook is actually positive, despite, maybe talking here for the last half an hour in a kind of more negative space. But that I do personally feel that, this none of these things are going to actually happen,
No, I
or if
think,
they do,
yeah, I
yes,
think you're
sorry.
right. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut across you there.
No, I
Just
was finished.
yeah, I think the digital ID plan is a roll of the dice. It's you can smell the fear. It's bicycle clip time with these people, fresh underpants. They're thinking we've got to get this done because we're running out of road here. We've got to get people locked down. We've got to get them into this system completely. Because we are running out of time. You can just sense that, right? So many whether it's political figures or, whatever you categorize as international elites. I mean, what's happened since COVID to, you don't hear about Klaus Schwab very much anymore, do you? He seems to have disappeared from the scene. All of this stuff that was seemingly so certain, as we talked about earlier, in terms of,
Yeah, but I think a lot of these guys are pantomime vi villains in a sense. Do you know what I mean? Nearly, he's a good example of one, where everybody's ire is directed at that particular character actor. And my feeling is that, what the people that we're dealing with are the forces that we're dealing with here are not particularly visible to us,
No, I think you're right, and you
in
can
the
have.
way that, I'm not saying that he is, doesn't have power and influence, he certainly does. And Bill Gates would be another one, certainly has power and influence. But I think the actual forces at play here are names and people we probably don't know who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I did a video, or an interview rather, during COVID period, a lot of entitled "War on Humanity by Non-Human Forces," when I referenced a lot of the work of Rudolf Steiner, which I really got into. I was aware of him, of course, but I really got into exploring his writings, not the easiest to comprehend at times during the C-19 period, and the spiritual
Yeah.
dimension that he talks about. And I do think you're right. There's some, people like Klaus Schwab, these pantomime villains, as you say, are really on the surface, they're the appearance of this thing, but not the ultimate force. And I think that they can be a lightning rod in a way. They can draw our ire, draw all our attention and energy, and then they disappear. And it's almost like, oh, well, the threat isn't there anymore because old Klaus has gone to his retirement home in the Swiss Alps or whatever, And yeah, he's an absolutely ridiculous figure. You expect you look at the guy, and it's literally like, which Bond film that I've never seen is he in?
He's a good these people are good lightning rod for our attention and focus. As in, they're useful tools for a distraction of our attention and focus. But I think at the end of the when I go through all of the things that are going on at the moment and what has happened in the past is, it does come back to your own grounding for what's coming ahead, and how people, in a sense, to change the world, you need to change your own world first, and how that looks to you, so that we, as you related earlier, is a commitment to stay positive on things and stuff like that, and that's exactly like that's exactly correct.
Yeah, I think it's in like Thomas Sheridan. I don't know about yourself, but I was a big fan of early U2, particularly the
So
first
was
three or
I.
four albums. But I think it's in the song "Rejoice" that Bono sings, "I can't change the world, but I can change the world in me." And it's kind of like attend to yourself, and then everything else follows. And it always reminds me of the notice that you see on airplanes. Do attach your own oxygen mask before attempting to help anybody else.
Well, absolutely, and you two are probably a good example of, a band that started out as a kind of a Christian rock band, and in a sense, you might say that they got tempted by the idea that they could have an influence in the world, in a positive way, and they got lost quickly.
Yeah, I think in particular Bono. I always got the feeling that Adam Clayton, the bass player, really didn't give a fuck. He was kind of like
Always, always err on the side that might have a drug or alcohol problem as being the person that might be the one that is the one most uncomfortable with the fame.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, we've been talking now for about 70 minutes, and
Oh, have we?
if listeners are wondering why your audio has changed, it's because you've gone outside to have a cigarette. So,
Sorry.
no, that's right. You haven't quite cleaned all the vices out of your life.
That's for sure.
Mine is coffee, I would say, and possibly pies. If there's one thing that's going to be the death of me, it's pies. But in any event, maybe we could just talk a little, reminisce a little bit about Ireland past, and maybe, end up talking about the future of the country, to such that we can say anything about it. There was one thing that really struck me early on in reading your book, when you mentioned in Ireland, particularly in decades gone by, this phrase confirmed bachelors. And it just resonated so strongly with me, because I start thinking, yes, more so than anywhere else in the British Isles that I've lived, even in my corner of Ireland up in the northwest. When I was a teenager during the 1980s, there were these guys, these men, usually older men, that they were, again, as you say, confirmed bachelors, but not necessarily confirmed by themselves, maybe confirmed by the female community or whatever. And I just knew, so not even knew, but I was aware of so many of them. Our family solicitor at the time, even into his, I don't know where he is now, maybe he's retired, but into his middle age, was living at home with his mother. His father had long since died. All he did was play golf, but he went home at night to with his mother, and he had his own bedroom still in the house, I knew a couple of brothers who lived on a farm, which is gradually just coming apart, because they were just failing to keep up with the latest technology. They couldn't do it. They were getting older. They had no wives, no children. These two twin brothers, that their parents had died, and they lived on the farm with their parents, and there they were trying to cope with this going forward. A real throwback to like
Hello.
a bygone age.
Yeah, I suppose in Ireland, in the part of Ireland I grew up in the West, a lot of it, historically had to do with economic circumstances, and an Ireland that had a responsibility and duty of care to, the parents that were alive and, the land that they grew up in. Now, there was also an element of a comfortability with a certain amount of oddness in your community, if you know. Odd characters who, weren't, who were probably medicated from a young age in today's world, who maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, they were just people that you kind of, the community kind of made elbow room for. But they're almost certainly, that category of person is completely gone from Ireland, and if they do, they're probably, in some sort of care facility or something like that. But yeah, like life, they give a flavor to my youth anyway. And I've mentioned one of them. I've written a story about one in particular in the book, but yeah, so that, yeah, that confirmed bachelors are history.
Yeah, and I remember, and I had this thought, it would have been during the 2000s, infrequently going back home to Northern Ireland, maybe once a year, twice a year, that I remember seeing some guys around town, sort of late middle-aged men, maybe early 60s, and looking exactly like the late middle-aged or early 60s kind of guys that I saw in the 70s and the 80s. And I remember doing a bit of crunching a few numbers and thinking, well, when I was a teenager in the 80s, these guys would have been in their 30s. But yet here they are now in tweed jackets and flat caps, looking exactly like the older men from decades gone by. At what point did they go from being 30 something guys in the 80s that I didn't really notice because they were just men about town? At what point did they transition into the flat cap and just becoming their father? It was just a strange process to me, because even today, I don't own a flat cap. I don't envision ever transitioning into being my own father.
Yeah, no, I were you know, I grew up working in pubs, and it's probably the best education you get in terms of access to large amounts of humanity and different types of human characteristics. And one of the things I would have noticed about what you're saying there is what you'd have found in the West of Ireland in the 80s was at a certain point, maybe in their 20, 21 or 22, young men have a decision to make. Do they leave Ireland or do they stay in a kind of hopeless situation where, casual labor, unemployment benefits, and a lot of them leave and go to, at that time they'd have gone to London or America. But what you'd often find with a certain category of that person was they wouldn't be able to handle the big city or leaving the country for too long. And a certain trickle of them would come back maybe after a year or 18 months, where maybe they had too much freedom, as in they weren't able to handle it. So whether they'd develop a drink problem or whatever kind of problem, but you'd often find them coming back to a community, and that's when kind of they'd almost make a decision unconsciously as to how the rest of their life would transpire. And so maybe that might be an explanation for a certain number of the tweed caps that you might
Yeah.
have encountered. But you don't see too many of them now, I'd say that much.
No, I'm sure not. I remember watching a very interesting documentary many years ago about this snooker player, Alex Higgins, from the North. And when he was a young man setting out on the snooker scene, and he went over to, the mainland, as they say in Father Ted, because he's going to have to be there if he's going to get connections and make it. And that's when his problem with alcohol started, because he was so homesick. And involved in the rock scene, I knew a couple of brothers who had a band together in Omagh, which is another town in the north of Ireland. And at one point, would have been, I suppose, in the early 90s, the four of them, the two brothers and their two bandmates, went over to London again to try and make it. They were only there for a matter of weeks, and they were back home because they were homesick for the farm that they grew up on. And it wasn't a way that I saw the world. I really wanted to go to the mainland for to meet more people and to have more things going on. And nothing wrong with my home, but there was just everything was in Belfast. There was nothing locally. The railway had closed down during the Dr. Beeching era. Our cinema closed in the 80s. You know what I mean? Things were just contracting at a time when in England, Scotland, and Wales, for the most part, they were expanding.
Absolutely. And you see, nowadays in Ireland, like most kids in Ireland do their, and for the last 20, like even my generation, going back to my generation, and you see, my generation, which would be, well, I'm 52, we were the first people that came out of the Irish education system that had the option, most of us, to stay at home and find a job. And but that only kind of happened on the flip of a coin when I was about 23 or 24. So when I went into university, I fully expected to have to leave Ireland. But by the time I came out of the university system, Ireland had changed. So what you find nowadays is most kids do their gap year in Australia or go wherever they go, but it's as a matter of choice. Whereas back maybe just a decade earlier, a lot of the people getting on the boats and the planes didn't want to leave, and that homesickness was, that in a sense, that deep love of their land, their piece of land in the world, was something that they could never let go of. And that would, a lot of that, especially in, the likes of, Cricklewood and areas of London, Kilburn, like that, if you might, if you ever frequent a bar there, back in the day, you'd find so many characters like crying about whatever part of Belmullet they're from. They miss it so much, and they never go back, even though they could get on a plane and hop back. But it's like this deep pain of loss that they have. And while that's not there today, which in a sense is probably good, our people are still leaving in quite significant numbers and almost equivalent numbers, nowadays, for different reasons, not because they can't get a job, but because they can't rent an apartment,
Well,
or they,
yeah.
you know, it's a it, it's a different type of problem they're facing. And that is becoming increasingly apparent with the numbers. You see, the Ireland's picture, because it's so small, is changing very rapidly. because we have the influx of people for the last 10 or 15 years, but we also have the outflow st going on as well with our youth. So me as a 52-year-old looking at Ireland has noticed the changes, but I can still find a lot of 52-year-olds who are Irish in the way I'm Irish. Whereas my son, who's 22, his vision of the world is completely different to mine, because that element of Irishness is not at all the same. His vision of Ireland is one that's probably 45 to 50% non-Irish.
Now,
In
I
where.
remember when I went to university in 1990, my grandmother saying to me at the time, "Oh, sure, could you not go to the University of Ulster? You know, it's just down the road," sort of thing. And I'm saying, "Well, I haven't applied to there. You know, I want to go to England. You know, but yeah, but if you were here, you could come back home at night. You know, and you could stay in your own bed," sort of thing. And I said, "But I don't want that. You know." But so, do you think that? Well, that sense that you spoke about, that kind of longing, you know, that kind of that heartbreak, it's something that I feel partly attached to, but also at a distance from in terms of being Irish. You know, I don't feel that sort of tragic romantic thing, you know, that a lot of people, and maybe it's like an exaggerated cliche, but you know, a lot of people associate with the Irish that kind of like, oh, you know, certainly, sort of, you know, just happy souls, the life and soul of the party, always ready for a bit of carrying on, but there's some kind of, you know, shadow there and over their heart, you know, and I you know, a tragic romantic thing. Is there any, you know, hope for the future in that? You talked about the changes that have been happening. You know, is that gone in terms of like,
Well, I don't the answer the obvious the logical answer is to say no, there is no hope because of what's kind of happened in such a concentrated period of time. There is no hope as in the turnaround of the demographics of the population. But yet, at some level, I do believe that there is hope, and just in the the diaspora, as we call it, the Irish diaspora, right? They always had, and I want to bring this back to Ireland, is the Irish diaspora had a closeness to the symbols of Ireland that we didn't actually possess in the South, to the flag, to St. Patrick's Day. These were symbols of hope that kept them in touch with their country. Now, what you find is that those symbols are becoming more and more important to the indigenous population of Ireland, given what's happened. It's almost like we're a diaspora in our own country. So we've had a lot of controversy about people, how the Irish flag should be displayed in Ireland over the last 6 months. And, the state kind of trying to say, they need to reclaim the flag because, all these inverted commas far right people are using it at protests or outside the our parliament. So that would indicate that gives you a kind of idea of the psychological flip that's happened in Ireland, where that we're increasingly immigrants on our own island.
Yeah, well, you got the same issue. I've just come back from Scotland where I was on holiday, and there was no problem that I could see about flying the Saltair, you know, from public buildings or indeed private ones. And it seemed to me that amongst the British Isles, and well, not British Isles, that includes the Republic of Ireland, but amongst the English, the Scottish, and the Welsh, that it's only the English that have some kind of existential crisis, not maybe amongst the working classes, but certainly amongst the, you know, the chattering classes and the middle class and whatever, the elites, of like, you know, having an English flag, St. George Cross, you know, flying from the top of your house or on your front lawn or something is kind of like some kind of neo-Nazi statement, you know.
Well, it's the same in like that is increasingly how the state is looking upon people who fly an Irish flag, an Irish flag on their house now, that it is some sort of it says something politically about you that the government doesn't like.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I don't it's it's kind of it's kind of weird because in the South we were much more attached to our county colours than we were to the Irish flag, if you like, because of the Gaelic Athletic Association is like one of the pillars of Irish contemporary Ireland, but are also historic Ireland. And so no matter which of the 32 counties, north or south, you go to, people would be more inclined, you'd be more inclined to find the flag of your local county flying on a public house or a public building as much as the Irish flag. But that situation, not that that situation is reversing, but there's a lot of controversy about the flying of our national flag in Ireland at the moment, which I find totally bizarre.
Well, yeah, symbols have power, don't they? Whatever they're imbued with, and that can change over time. Classic example is the ancient to say the Hindu or Indian, I'm not quite sure, but what people have come to know as the swastika. As used by the Nazis, was actually the inversion of this very, very ancient sun symbol kind of thing, and it's like things, symbols and words, whatever, it could come down to people with whatever meaning they're imbued with in their age, and they take them at face value, and then the swastika now is just obviously emblematic with just unimaginable evil, and that will always be the case.
And and I agree. And like, and where you, where I look is this is where creation is a big part of the future. Is whatever the historical nature of that flag is, my way of looking at that is we lost that battle. There's no point trying to reclaim some lost symbol, as much as there should be a focus on, well, what new symbols can we create, that there basically is no political battle over, so that, and move in that direction.
Yeah, well, I guess, but anything can be purloined, can't it? Anything can be hijacked in that sense, no question about it. Well, maybe a closing thought for me, Jerry, just about my little corner of Ireland that I mentioned earlier, about during the 80s, and we had, well, of course, the railway had closed down, as I mentioned, in the 50s with Beeching, that whole thing with lots of railway closures throughout Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And the cinema went away in the 80s. That was, some of the most formative experience. As a movie fan, I remember going to see Alien there, in 1979, as a rated X, shouldn't really have been allowed in. Went to see The Empire Strikes Back in 1981 on a double bill with Star Wars. Saw Monty Python films there. So it was a real formative experience for me. And, before the age of the VHS. When you could have you rent movies to have at home, all of that went away in the early 90s. I don't know if it was coincidental, but after I'd left home to go to university in England, on my return trips, I felt that my little town of when we moved there in 1979, about 10,000 people, it's now just over 20,000 people, in the early 90s was undergoing a renaissance. We had a delicatessen opened up. There was more than one bakery. Do you know what I mean? And it was kind of feeling that it was maybe catching up a little bit with trends on the mainland. But with friends I have who have been friends all my life, who still live back there, they've confirmed really in terms of what their children want to do in terms of their future. Like, some of them have even ended up in America. That's kind of gone away. That was a brief burst of kind of activity, and there is a kind of a. I still think where I'm from is a beautiful place geographically. Probably quite a good place to bring up children in terms of safety, but there's a kind of gradual hollowing out of it in terms of I'm not quite sure what it'll look like in, 20 years' time from now. So yeah, it's just a feeling of like we've gone into reverse. And I mentioned to you, I sent you a link to an article about a tour that Meatloaf, the American singer and his band did in Ireland in 1989. I remember when that actually happened, and I remember thinking, wow, so Meatloaf isn't playing anywhere else in the world really at the minute, but he's doing this massive tour of Ireland. How to make us as Irish people feel behind the times, that he's chosen to do this.
Yeah, but the one of the sad things about that now is that would, with all of the progress and all of the economic improvement in Ireland, if a Meatloaf character existed today and decided to do that, he wouldn't be able to do it because he wouldn't be able to get venues to hold it. So a lot of the authentic organic spaces that existed for, something like that, we'll say, would be completely all closed down over the years through, health and safety or whatever it might be, where you could get 1,000 or 2,000 people, in here in the town I live in, you could get 2,000 people into a local place out the road, handy enough, that you couldn't get 200 people into now, or 300 people into. So yeah, when I saw that, I was thinking, in Ireland, the great, it would have been North and South, the old show band era, where they, every, similarly, there was a number of bands, lots of them that would tour the country like that, and but tour like towns and villages where maybe 1,500 people would gather. Which is totally, with all the economic expansion, would those spaces no longer exist?
No, there was a lot of. I remember in our local, say town, the business landscape in the 1980s. There was a chamber of commerce in the local town. They're very protectionist, and they things that people in the town might have wanted, like especially after the troubles began to ease off, British companies or other international companies wanted to open up businesses. Branches of their business in Northern Ireland, and there was tremendous re resistance to this. Sainsbury's wanted to open a supermarket, Boots wanted to open a pharmacy, all these sorts of things, and that was massively resisted. And then at some point, there was kind of like a tipping point was reached when that suddenly became possible, usually by like some sort of parasitic takeover of a host. I noticed that there was a Northern Ireland supermarket chain. Can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but Sainsbury's bought the entire chain wholesale, ran it as whatever it was, for a year, and then suddenly they were all rebranded, as Sainsbury's.
Yeah, so there's a like I've written about this in the South. In the South, that equation would look like every town has a Tesco, Lidl, and Aldi, and there's a so that if you take out the jobs element to that, or what you'd say is there's a creeping sameness about every town and village where once upon a time every town and village had their own uniqueness. And one of those uniquenesses might be what a local supermarket looked like, because it would usually have been owned by somebody in the locality, and they'd have their own way and means of doing things that might be different to the supermarket 10 miles down the road. Whereas the map, the kind of global map that, and that's another interesting characteristic. If you want to look at COVID in different ways, as I tend to do, is like we had to shut down the whole world for a virus, but we only had to shut down businesses with less than five people. If you had a business that had 1,000 people, well, you were free to do what you want. So
Oh yeah, I mean, sure
was
thing.
like,
You go to Tesco, you're fine. If you want to go to Jerry O'Neill's corner shop, no, you're going to get COVID in there.
So these, I suppose, over to, it depends. Like I, people often use the phrase, "What will future generations think?" And one of the things I'd say is, well, there is the uncertainty of how many future generations there will be, unless there is an energetic reaction to all of this, which I am leaning towards there being. But I would have said the dark road ahead, if the dark road or the dark path would. Does come to pass, is there are not too many future generations left to humanity. So that, in essence, that is the fight, despite whatever form it takes in whatever, digital ID, COVID, mass immigration. That's the energetic fight that is at our doorstep, and that are, at least for me, that's how I interpret it. And so that's why it's, in a sense, it's vitally important. I'm as strong as I can be, you're as strong, everybody is as strong as they can be, for, the years ahead.
That is a great point to end on, but I am going to add one little positive note at the end. Another thing that jumped out at me from your book, once again, that's Unvaxxed Soul, A Post-Pandemic Spirit Journey, was this thing of the Midnight Feast. When I read that in your book, I went, no fucking way. Are you kidding me? This guy's done what me and my friend Sean used to do in the garden shed. Literally buying food in the supermarket in the afternoon, and then for some reason at around about a midnight, going into, in our case, the shed to eat like Jaffa cakes and pork pies. And what the hell was that about? But clearly we weren't alone.
No. No, like that was, I suppose that's about the, for us growing up, and the incident in that, I'd say I was about 10 when that happened, or 11. But it, I suppose it's indicative of the types of freedom and kind of, curious minds are, we were explorers growing up. That's, we always saw, we were fortunate that we grew up across the road from our primary school. So the primary school was the only piece, the only property within, 5 miles that had concrete. So, during the summer, it was our World Cup, or it was our Wimbledon, or it was our Olympics. And our imagination, it was the place where our adventure started. So we always used to meet in the school grounds during the summer holidays, and we'd just say, let's go on an adventure. And that adventure would bring you into fields and trees and bushes and dikes and wherever, rivers and all that kind of stuff. So I suppose that, and the Midnight Feast, I suppose, were a part of that, because, we couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah, it was just an odd resonance for me because we thought we were pioneers, like having a load of food in the garden shed was like, nobody else in the world is doing this,
Yeah, well,
Anyway,
Paul.
Jerry, great conversation. I've enjoyed it very much, and we could talk no doubt for another 90 minutes. Maybe we'll pick this up again in future. But I mentioned earlier, let's say your book, Unvaxxed Soul, A Post-Pandemic Spirit Journey, is widely available. People can find links to get that on the interview page for this. Before we sign off, is there anything you'd like to share with listeners, your online presence or anything about getting the book?
No, I suppose the book is self-published, and it's mainly, like, it's available in local bookshops around here, but for your audience, the best method of getting it is through Amazon, .co.uk, just Unvaxxed Soul. And my own presence is, my day-to-day writing takes place on The West's Awake on Substack, if anyone is bananas enough to want to go over there and have a look, you're welcome aboard. But other than that, no, just thanks for the opportunity to talk.
No, you're very welcome. So, yeah, once again, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us today on legalizefreedom.com.
Excellent. Thanks, Greg.